Welcome into the Pipeline Podcast, our winter meetings edition. Tim McMaster here along with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo in person again. It's been a while. I think the All-Star game may be a futures game for edition of this podcast, but nice of you guys to be here on the couch here for the winter meetings podcast. And from a prospect standpoint, been a little bit quiet as far as the winter meetings go. We'll get into the big deals the Red Sox move, but overall not a lot of prospects moving this week.
No, yet. You know, as we sit here talking, and I think the last couple of years have taught us that sometimes it takes a few days for those to come to fruition, and I think we might see more. But Jim may disagree with you that there haven't been a lot of prospects because he's been ridiculously busy updating that Red Sox list.
Jim has had to add six players to the Red Sox top 30 in the last 24 hours.
I did. The Red Sox have been keeping me busy, but I was going to say, I think part of the reason it might be a little slower was just because we had that CBA uncertainty heading into the meetings. And so while teams were having discussions, you weren't quite sure what are the rules going to be on free. You know, they aren't as far along as some of the other decisions they might have made. You know, a lot of times it's easier to make a trade if you maybe, hey, we're going to make this free agent signing to fill a hole that might be created by the trade. So I think that's maybe led it to being a little slow. But, of course, as we've said this, there'll probably be eight trades between the time we record this and the time it runs.
We're going to look ahead to the Rule 5 draft in this podcast. We're also going to look at a new kind of neat deal between Major League Baseball and really the high school level in USA Baseball. I will also take a look ahead to the Scouts Awards, which come up here at the winter meetings. But let's start with those big Red Sox trade. And the big one was obviously Chris Sale, and the White Sox get quite a package. And they weren't going to give up Chris Sale if they weren't going to get the big package. I'll start with you, Jim, because you had to replace all these guys on the Red Sox list, but the number one prospect in baseball, Yoan Moncada, the Red Sox spent so much money on him just a couple of years ago. Now he is a member of the Chicago White Sox organization. How quickly does he get in to the Major League club?
Well, I mean, the White Sox are obviously entering on a full-scale rebuilding. From a service time standpoint, it doesn't make sense for him to make the opening day roster. From a development standpoint, this is a guy who's played about a month and a half in Double-A, looked a little, overmatched in his brief big league stint. I would think you send him to AAA, and you think about a midseason call-up if he is, there's no need to rush him.
I think he's the opening day second baseman. I think they want to show return on that investment. He was already up in the big leagues. He's on the 40-man roster. I say let him go.
Okay, we're going to vehemently disagree on this one because the guy
I love when Jim vehemently disagrees.
I love when you're in person to do it, too.
We're going to fisticuffs here. We're in this video, too.
That's like your word of the week, fisticuffs.
Fisticuffs. I've thrown out there twice. But he clearly was not ready for the big leagues last September. And I think it would be, if they put him on the opening roster, let's just revisit Byron Buxton all over again. It's foolish to, and I'm not saying you're wrong. It may happen for the reasons you said. It would be a bad decision on the White Sox part. There's nothing to be gained from having him in the big leagues. If I'm a White Sox fan and my team's going to lose 95 games next year, I'm not going to feel any, significantly better just because Yoan Moncada was on the opening day roster and played all year. He's not ready developmentally. Developmentally, it makes no sense. And from a business standpoint, why have this guy become arbitration eligible and free agent eligible before he has to? So it's foolish. But I will say, we're just speculating that would be a bad decision. I was impressed by I was impressed by what the White Sox got for him, because being based in Chicago, I swear I've done at least 20 Chris Sale speculative podcasts or radio shows since the end of the season. Where's he going to go? Where are they going to get? Et cetera, et cetera. And you didn't know where he was going to go. The Red Sox were a prime candidate. But he's so good as a pitcher, just pure talent, and his contract is so team friendly. He makes $38 million over the next 3 years combined, which is barely
still young
more
too.
Than what Zach Greinke or David Price or Clayton Kershaw are going to make this year alone.
Right.
That I thought it was going to be very difficult to get fair value, full value for Chris Sale. And so my standard line on all these radio shows, podcasts was, not that I don't trust the White Sox, but I just think it's going to be hard to get what he's worth. So I predict I will not like what they get in return. I will think they did not get enough, and I don't think that at all. And in fact, I think the trade really sticks out to me, because when you trade a great player with a great contract like Chris Sale and you get a package of three or four guys, and you're counting on, let's say, at least three of those guys becoming good big leaguers, that's an awful lot to ask. I mean, we like prospects as much as anybody, but prospects don't all, reach their ceilings or even make it to the big leagues. But the way this deal is structured, if Yoan Moncada is good, as good or as close to as good as, Robinson Cano with more speed, right there, you made a good trade. And then on top of that, you got Michael Kopech.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about Kopech yet.
Who, gets then, compared to Noah Syndergaard stuff-wise, and he's one of the 10 or so best pitching prospects in the minors. If Moncada is what he's supposed to be, and then Kopech comes close to what he's supposed to be, then it's a great trade for the White Sox. I think they did very well, and the other two guys are interesting as well, Bisabi and Diaz.
Does Michael Kopech not get Noah Syndergaard comparisons if he doesn't have long blonde hair?
Well, I mean that helps. That helps, but I mean, and I know you're joking, but the reason he does though, no, I mean, you're talking about the guy. Kopech kind of gets
the stuff
second citizen status in this trade. But, you know, Noah Syndergaard's got the most electric stuff of any big league starter, and Michael Kopech probably has the most electric stuff of any minor league starter.
You know, if you told me 5 years from now that Michael Kopech might end up being the best player in this trade, I could see it. And I love Yoan Moncada, but I could see it happening because if everything clicks for Kopech, we're talking about a Noah Syndergaard. You know, I was making the joke about the locks out of jealousy, clearly. But, but yeah, I mean, we're talking a front of the rotation, number one, legitimate ace kind of guy. If it all comes together.
And to me, the downside in Kopech, if it doesn't come together, let's say the control doesn't get to where you want to be, I still think you're looking at a closer. We might be talking about a closer who's averaging 100 miles an hour coming out of the bullpen.
Yep.
So, it's like I think that's where the White Sox did a really nice job is they don't have to have three or four guys come through, even if it's just Yoan Moncada, it's going to be a good trade. You could argue if Michael Kopech reaches his ceiling. He could be worth Chris Sale straight up. And so I think what they did from talking to people, I think one of the things they did that I heard that was a nice job is they didn't look at this like we have to trade Chris Sale. It's like we need to rebuild. Let's see what we can get for him. But it sounds to me from talking to people that they knew who they wanted with specific teams. Like if I'll use the Braves. Braves did not want to give up Dansby Swanson. But for the White Sox, if they were going to trade him to the Braves, Dansby Swanson was going to be the deal. Dansby Swanson's not available? Okay, we don't need to talk. We're not going to negotiate down. And I think, it sounds like the Nationals, there was thought that, I think the Nationals were the other team that was willing to give up what it was going to take, and the Red Sox happened to trump their offer.
And maybe the Red Sox threw in two other players, too. We talked about Kopech and Moncada, obviously. Luis Alexander, Bisabe, and Victor Diaz as well. Two other guys in the top 30. I mean, they're not that top-level guys. But you mentioned the Nationals, and I want to get your guys' take because that package, reportedly, we don't know for sure what exactly the Nationals were going to give up. But it's been kind of reported. Lucas Giolito, Victor Robles, Reynaldo Lopez, basically the top three prospects in the national system. You take that versus what the Red Sox did give up. In your mind, did the White Sox take the best offer?
I hadn't heard that it also included Lopez.
And it may not have, but for this game, that's what we're going with.
That's close. I think that's close, especially because you'd be getting two really good pitching prospects, both of whom are ready to contribute at the big league level. You'd have them under control for a long time. Plus Victor Robles, who we've talked a lot about between the two of us, is a guy who's obviously not under the radar because he's highly ranked, but I think he may be underappreciated because he's not exploded on the national scene yet. But he is one of the most dynamic offensive prospects in baseball. I don't know. I think that's awfully close. I'm not sure. I might have taken the Nationals offer just to because of the extra arm.
I will less vehemently disagree with Jonathan. So that would be intriguing, but I would take the Red Sox offer. I might be about as big a Victor Robles fan as anyone.
Yeah.
I think there's a chance that you could argue he has the best tools of any player in the minor leagues right now, and that a year from now he might be the best prospect in baseball as he continues to develop and other guys graduate off the list. But I would still take Moncada over Robles, and you've got infielder versus outfielder, even though Robles is up the middle, at least at center field. And I think the gap between Kopech and Giolito may not be nearly as much as we thought it was.
That's fair.
What you said with Reynaldo Lopez, getting him as a major league ready arm as third guy in the deal, that would be tempting. But I think I would have gone for the upside of the Moncada. Moncada Robles. That would have been a nice package. Moncada Kopech package. And you mentioned Bisabe, and he's not at the level of a Reynaldo Lopez, but he's a very toolsy guy. He's still young and raw, but he might be a guy we're talking about as a top 100 prospect in a couple of years.
It's fascinating that the Nationals here, the home team, and it's been so far as we record this, just kind of a disappointing run. We thought maybe McCutcheon, he's still a Pirate, so who knows, but you don't know. They lose out on Melanson. They lose out on Sale. We'll see how they kind of recover from this, and maybe they still have a big deal in them before we all leave their area of the country. We will see. The other prospect deal that of note The Brewers getting a couple of guys for Tyler Thornburg as the Red Sox help out the bullpen as well. Lesser guys, obviously, not your Yoan Moncada or Michael Kopech, but still some intriguing guys. Jim, I'll let you start because the Red Sox are your team. Poor Jonathan. Have you done? Have you just been twiddling your thumbs here?
I'm just going to drop the mic. I wrote the.
Glad he didn't do the Red Sox.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm fine with it. And I did write the analysis piece yesterday on the big trade. So, but yes, we can start with Jim on the Thornburg deal.
Mauricio Dubon is kind of a fascinating story. I think we did a short clip for MLB.com yesterday where we couldn't really get into it, but his story of how he came to the United States is fascinating, and he's got some upside.
Yeah, he's from Honduras. He's trying to become the second Honduran-born player to reach the big leagues after Gerald Young, although when I talked to him in the fall league and I asked about that, he just shook his head and went, no. No, don't write that. The people back home will be very angry because Gerald Young did not grow up in Honduras. So I think the Hondurans consider, you know, Mauricio Dubon the first full-fledged.
Gerald Young was like on a military base or something like
so,
that, right?
I think so
he
so,
wasn't.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But anyway, I said, you know, he was born in Honduras, and Mauricio was just like, no, don't. I'm telling you, the guys back home will not be happy with you. But so anyway, he was 15, and there was a Christian missionary group that also was involved with baseball that came to Honduras from the U.S. And he went back with him to the U.S. so he could attend high school in the U.S. and try to, you know, help his baseball career. And he wound up getting drafted by the Red Sox in the later rounds. And he emerged. You know, yeah, he isn't Moncada and he isn't Kopech. But had we fully updated our Red Sox farm system before the winter meetings, Mauricio Dubon would have been their sixth or seventh best prospect. He was right there with Luis Alexander Basabe, you know, depending on which one you like better. But I really like him. I mean, yes, Dustin Pedroia doesn't seem like he's ever going to leave, and all these second basemen get pushed aside, and he can play shortstop, but yeah. Xander Bogaerts is going to be there for 10 or 15 years at this rate. But Mauricio Dubon, he's not a power hitter, but he does everything else really well. He hits, he puts the bat on the ball, he's a solid runner. He can play solid defense at short, second. He played some center field in the fall league. I think at the very worst, he gives you a good utility man. But I think he's actually a guy who can be an everyday player on a contending club, which the Brewers aren't going to be right now. But I think he's a little bit of a sleeper who doesn't get the due because the Red Sox system was kind of like these five top 100 guys and everyone else and the views of many people. But he's a really talented player.
Yeah, and, you know, I think if he continues his development, you know, at a sort of normal clip, right when the Brewers, I think, are hoping to be back and competitive again based on all the moves they made, is right when he's going to be ready to hit the big leagues in some fashion. And they'll have the ability, depending on who's playing where. I mean, he's not going to play shortstop in Milwaukee, I don't think. I think Arcia is probably going to, you know, be just fine there. But maybe he does move around at first. And he looked pretty good in center field when I saw him. I didn't get long looks at him, but he didn't look uncomfortable concerning he hadn't played out there before. And he's a plus makeup guy, really personable. I think you know, it's interesting that the Red Sox sort of, with all the trades they've made in the last year, they keep being able to trade away these middle infielder types because there's no place to put them. You know, Javi Guerra goes to San Diego, and everyone's like, well, he wasn't going to play in Boston anymore, and I think the same can be said for Dubon.
That's why you keep drafting up the middle, right? Draft yeah. after draft after draft, because the value that those guys have, whether or not they make it up to your major league club. How about Josh Pennington? He was the other guy in that deal, another top 30 guy.
Right, but not put on the Brewers top 30. Okay. The Brewers, you know, they've accrued
Brewers
so much.
A little bit deeper than the Red Sox list, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, just especially
now,
especially right now. In fact, at one point, I was referring to a guy on the list. Oh, I think it was Victor Diaz.
Victor Diaz,
and I'm like, oh, he's number 30, and I'm like, no, he's 28. Wait, he's 24. What? I mean, Pennington's just an arm strength guy, right? So probably a bullpen.
He's
short
young.
Reliever
yeah,
kind of
I mean, he was a guy who was actually one of the top high school pitchers in the Northeast. And had Tommy John surgery his senior year, and the Red Sox still were able to sign him for $90,000, I think, in the 29th round. So they were bringing him back slowly. He's 95, 98. The control hasn't been there yet, but, you know, if he wants to be a reliever, 95, 98 still works, yep. And he's still young enough. I think he's maybe 21 right now, that you still can try to develop him as a starter. So, like, I thought both teams that made the moves with the Red Sox yesterday had done their homework. I mean, they got good guys. You know, Victor Diaz was a guy who a lot of people were interested in, too. And just to get to your point, too, about, you know, when Jonathan was saying they have all these young guys, Dave Dombrowski actually mentioned that during his press conference, which we heard in the media room yesterday, that it made it a little easier to give up the talent they've been giving up when you look at how they probably have the best young core players in the big leagues along with the Cubs.
Right.
And so when you have a Bogarts and a Betts and a Bradley, and I, you know, still high hopes for Blake Swihart, and they kept Andrew Benintendi, that's a pretty ridiculous core of five guys there. So,
Not that Dave Dombrowski has ever shied away from trading away young talent, so I neither here or there. But it is nice to have that group, knowing that you're going to have them for a long time.
And that said, I mean, he also was part of a great player development machine when he was with the Expos. And I know that was a while ago, but, you know, it's funny because when he took the Boston job, I had people ask me, like, Dave Dombrowski hates prospects. He's going to trade them all away. And I don't think it's that. I think in Detroit.
Although it has happened.
Well, but I think he's doing the job he was hired to do.
Yes.
And in Detroit, I mean, it was no secret. Mike Ilitch is in his 80s, wants to win another World Series. And so it's like, we're all in for the future. Now Detroit's kind of on the verge of paying the price for that because they don't have a deep farm system. They have an old, expensive club. You look in Boston, Ben Cherington, who probably deserves more credit than he gets for not trading Mookie Betts and Xander Bogaerts and Jackie Bradley when these guys were unproven and struggling and the big league team was not doing well. You know, Ben Cherington was kind of the last vestige of the Theo Epstein days where we're trying to build this player development machine. And Dave Dombrowski was not brought in to, okay, let's develop these guys and see how it pans out. Dave Dombrowski was brought in over Ben Cherington, and then Ben Cherington resigned, to win now. So, again, I don't know why I'm becoming a Dave Dombrowski apologist about trading prospects, but I think he's simply doing what he was hired to do. I don't think he's necessarily Mr. Quick Fix, we got to get rid of all the young guys. I think he's doing what he was brought in to do.
Right, and it was a kind of maybe a perfect storm, you know, a recipe of things that worked to sort of fulfill that prophecy of him being the guy to trade away prospects.
And the pressure now, I guess, goes on the player development, the scouting staff, to now replenish that supply. If the Tigers had been able to do that, maybe they'd have another group coming up. Of course, it's tough because once you're in that upper echelon, you're not drafting as highly. And now with the new international rules, probably maybe even tougher, because even though those are big market teams, they can't go out there and give Yoan Moncada $30 million.
So it's interesting you brought up the internationals, because I was talking to an international scouting director last night, and I was asking him, like, do you feel like you're completely handcuffed by this? And he actually said no, which I was surprised. Now, yeah, you can't go over like you used to, but if you're a team that wins every year,
you're
given
attractive, right?
He's getting more money now.
We're going from 2.2 million to 5 million. I'm like, I'm good, you know?
Yeah.
And they weren't necessarily a team that would exorbitantly spend internationally, but it was a perspective I hadn't even thought of where, aside from the penalties, and that's a whole other thing that, you know, they have.
Don't make my head spin again like you did last week.
I want to see it. It's on video. I'd like to see your head spin. Like 360, you know, like on a swivel. But they supposedly have these, like, draconian death penalty if you go over where they're going to cut your funding, the money you can use in half
for the life of the CBA.
For the life of the CBA. Okay. You're a team that wants to sign Ohtani, and he's going to fall, and if he's made available, he's going to fall under the auspices of this because he's going to be under 25.
Well, you can't go over, though. They just want to approve the contracts. I think that's more if you do something under the table and you get caught.
Oh, okay.
Because you can't pay.
What's going to keep you from just saying, all right, fine, cut me in half, I don't care.
I'll get my one player
They want to approve the contract. Right. But the two things, and I don't profess to know nearly as much about this stuff as Jesse Sanchez, but just thinking back to last week's podcast, are one, somebody brought up the point to me, Ben Battler from Baseball America, who's Baseball America's version is Jesse Sanchez, and he was saying, you know, because I said, you know, it seemed to me like this system's really going to be tough, like they're not going to spend as much money. He said, you know, it really only affects the big-time Cuban players, but so many of those guys have come out that most of the big-time Cubans are out. So those are going to be the guys, like, you know, there aren't more Yoan Moncadas coming. And then Ohtani, I still don't understand this. But I've seen written in reports that, like, oh, there may be ways around it. Because otherwise Ohtani would be best served to wait till 2019 when he's 25. But then there have been reports, I think Jeff Passan from Yahoo in particular, said, oh, there might be ways around it. And I asked somebody, like, what would that be? And simply put, they could amend the posting rules. You know, the union and MLB could amend the posting rules and basically make them whatever they want. So it's possible that they may come up with a way that it doesn't apply to Ohtani so that we get Ohtani after the 2017 season. Yeah. You know, so it'll
for the
be,
good of the game, I guess, would be the
I
right.
guess. Not for the
little
good of
digression
the game.
There. Yeah. But, yes. Ohtani is fascinating. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, let's move on a little bit from the prospects here this winter meetings to how this winter meetings ends every year, which is the Rule 5 draft. And it'll be streamed on MLB.com. We hit the airwaves at 8:55 a.m. Eastern time on Thursday morning. And it's always fascinating because a lot of people won't recognize the names that are necessarily taken in the Rule 5 draft, but suddenly a lot of these guys are going to spend the year on major league rosters, and a lot of them are going to end up being successful. But for people who aren't completely clear on the Rule 5 draft, Jonathan, you've done this a few hundred times in your life. Kind of fill us in on how it all works.
I'm gonna write Rule 5 the musical so we can do this song and dance version. So very basically, it's just another way for teams to find major league talent. Every team has a certain amount of time to allow players in the minor leagues to develop before they have to be put on the 40-man roster. The previous CBA, before this one, changed the rules where every team got an extra year. So now it's 4 years for a college player, 19 or older, and 5 years for 18 and younger. That includes high school kids and, of course, the international guys who signed at 16. If they're not put on the 40-man roster in their year, then they're eligible for the Rule 5 draft. They've upped the price to $100,000 to make a pick, which is still, I think, people have asked me, is that going to keep teams from taking it? I don't think so. And then it's $50,000 if you send them back. So still sort of bargain shopping. And lately, the name, there haven't been those big splash kind of names, I think largely because of that extra year of evaluation time. But especially the last 2 years, the success rate has gone way up. More guys have stuck. Joe Biagini and Matthew Bowman are probably the two that had the most significant roles on teams that were competitive last year. And it's been more of those kinds of guys than the, wow, this guy is, going to be an all-star kind of player.
Delano DeShields a couple years ago.
Odubel Herrera is a good player. I mean, DeShields didn't follow up his rookie year with with another good year. But, yeah, he was a good contributor, again, for a playoff team. So there's still talent to be found. And I think the most interesting sort of tidbit I got when I was doing the first preview and talking to Mike Radcliffe of the Twins, and they have the first pick, is – we talk about all the analytics and all the how much more data, and I had never thought of it like, well, how does that translate? They have so much more information about all of these players, so even if they're lesser names, there's a little more certainty, and I think that's a huge reason why teams have been more successful in finding guys who can stick in the big leagues.
And the tricky thing, as John said, they mentioned sticking in the big leagues, it's you don't just get to keep the player. That's the tough part of this. If they don't stay on your active roster in the big leagues all season, you have to clear him through waivers. All the other teams could get him, and he'd be subject to sim rules, and then offer him back to the team for half the price. You could play some DL games and rehab assignments, but he still has to be active in the big leagues for at least 90 days the following season, or you go through the same thing again the next year until he gets to 90 days. So it's, I almost wish they would just, if you're not protected on the 40-man roster, the other team, should be able, I almost feel like should be able to keep you. I don't know. If you aren't protected, it would make it, the rule is designed like almost 100 years ago. It's been around forever to protect teams from back when teams would stockpile minor league talent and give guys who are blocked a chance. And I think that would be well worth, if it were me, if I became the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred's probably okay. He doesn't have to worry about me. I would look at the Rule 5 rules and I almost say, look, if they're not protected on the 40-man roster, maybe raise the price to make it a more significant amount of money, but you can keep the guy.
Just keep him.
So keep him on your 40-man. Maybe back to big league roster. You have to keep him on your 40-man roster.
So when you look ahead to Thursday morning, and you mentioned the Twins with the first pick, but who are some names that we could see going early on in the Rule 5 draft?
Well, that's why I'm just pulling out the list that I have here. It's still sort of filtering in. I feel like teams, more and more, it's really a Wednesday night thing where they really try to hone in on.
I brought up maybe doing this in last week's podcast, and you were both like, no.
I did a radio show earlier, and they're like, who are some names? I'm like, I could just completely make up fictitious names, and you wouldn't know.
Where was the radio show that actually cared about the Rule 5 draft?
It was the Toronto, because of Biagini.
Okay.
Yeah, they asked me like 5 questions about the Rule 5 draft. Like, this is the most outside of our happy little family here that I've ever talked about the Rule 5 draft. The names that I'm hearing the most are a couple of sort of young arms from Latin America, Yimi Brassabon, Yanni Chirinos are both names that I'm hearing quite a bit. And then Eric Wood of the Pirates, who had a really good fall league, and was a guy who had been a pitcher as an amateur and then hitting full time once he joined the Pirates organization, had a solid year in AA and then had a really good fall league, and also showed some positional flexibility, third, first, and the outfield corner, and that often will help. So those are a couple names you want to throw in.
Brassabon's one I've heard a lot. Padres right-hander, throws 95-98. Another fall league guy that we both were impressed with when we saw him, Zach Vincy of the Reds, and he's an interesting one because he really had no track record of doing much at the plate. He had a better second half this year. He'd been in pro ball for 3 or 4 years, and they almost won the AFL Triple Crown. And he's a pretty good defensive player, so shortstop for the Reds might be interesting.
Yeah, he could play second, probably could play third if you needed him
to. Yeah, he's athletic enough to do that. Yep. Philip Evans of the Mets, another guy who can play all over the infield, won the Eastern League batting title this year, hit .335. So, like, you know, it's usually tougher to keep the position guys in the big leagues. But, you know, you won the batting title in AA, so you can see Philip Evans making that jump. And I think the Red Sox feel like they might lose Justin Haley, who has, you know, just by in terms of the radar gun, kind of average-ish stuff, but he seems to miss bats, and he's had success as a starter in AAA, and he might be a lower ceiling, higher floor Rule 5 pick who might be able to be somebody's fifth starter middle reliever next year.
Vincy, also a friend of the podcast.
That's right.
A few weeks ago, he's coming on from the Arizona Fall League. All right, so it's going to be exciting. It's always fun. You can listen in 8:55 a.m. as I said on MLB.com. Me and Jonathan will kind of set the stage, then we'll hand it over, and it is rapid fire. That's the one kind of neat thing about the Rule 5 draft.
And
is
no
it's
double
nonstop.
A phase anymore.
No double A
so
phase.
So it's just Major League, Triple A, and
be
done.
7 minutes long.
Yeah.
We'll move on. All right, excellent. A couple other things I wanted to talk about, and I mentioned the Scouts Dinner is coming up Wednesday night here at the Winter Meetings as we record this Wednesday afternoon. And awards are given out as part of that. And Jim, I know you're always in attendance. Who is being honored this time around as far as the Scouts go?
There's 4 guys. You know, it's kind of a lifetime achievement award. And they do it regionally. East Coast winner this year is Ed Creech, who's now with the Giants. He was scouting director for 4 teams, came up as an Expos area scout. The Central Division winner Midwest winner is Larry Corrigan of the Twins, who ironically have only signed 1 big leaguer because he wasn't an area scout for very long. He kind of went into upper scouting management, and he was with the Pirates, Angels briefly. He's back with the Twins now. The West Coast winner is Rick Schroeder, who's scouted for a number of teams, signed more than a dozen big leaguers. He's with the Texas Rangers now. And then they alternate, like, I guess in odd number of years, there's like a director's choice, which is just whoever they decide to give it to. And then the even number of years, it's an international award winner. And Pablo Cruz, who signed almost 24 big leaguers for the Pittsburgh Pirates, kind of came up under the legendary Howie Haake. He's your international winner this year. And that's tonight. I always love the event and talking to the scouts and hearing stories. And virtually every scouting director is in there. You see all kinds of scouts. You know, it's a great event.
All right, one other thing I wanted to touch on in this podcast. You have something? No? Okay. You're just getting the mic ready.
I'm getting ready. I'm teaming up. Come on.
It was announced today as far as press release coming out, but a new program that kind of brings together Major League Baseball and not the prospects we necessarily talk about, but younger level prospects, USA Baseball involved as well. It's called the Prospect Development Pipeline, PDP. The website will be up at some point in 2017, I know. But it's kind of a neat thing. It's coming together, Jonathan, and it's going to be really around the country, regionalized, and a chance for high school age kids to kind of get noticed, get right, recognized, and put their talents on the field.
Right. First, it was nice that they allowed us to have our branding on it, you know, the pipeline branding.
Yeah. But I thought maybe that was already copyrighted.
Well, no, we allowed them to use it, so it's really okay. I think it's a really interesting initiative that both USA Baseball and MLB have sort of joined together on. And there are going to be 5 regional events before the high school season, so it's like in January, February. Obviously in warm weather areas. And then there's going to be another dozen sort of late May, June, kind of post-high school season. The idea being the ones early are going to be mostly for guys who are graduating 2017, so 2017 draft kids. And then it'll be 2018 or 2019 kids. And the ones in the summer They're one-day events, kind of full evaluations. The Scouting Bureau is going to put together reports. Obviously, they're hoping scouts, area scouts, will come to all of them. In fact, scouts will be on the field instructing and coaching. And then in September, they're doing a whole advanced scout team, like championship tournament, a 16-team tournament, where they'll go out and just play games for 4 or 5 days. I think we're going to end up carrying some of those games in some capacity. That's going to be in September in Cary, North Carolina, at the USA Baseball Complex. And I think it's just another way for high school kids to be seen by teams and directly set up by the teams. I mean, there are general managers, scouting directors, and the like on the steering committee. So there's no middleman. There's no cost for any of the players. So it's just an easy way that all it is about is kids going out, getting some work instruction, some guidance, and some playing in front of the evaluator to make the decision if and when to draft them.
And you mentioned the coverage, and MLB Advanced Media is also a big part kind of the partnership, and a lot of that will be broadcast as well. That's going to do it for this Pipeline podcast. Just a note, programming note, the next Pipeline podcast next week, we're going to dig in to the new top 50 draft prospects, which will be out next week. Comes out the 13th.
Sure.
Sometime next week. But we will dive into that. So definitely tune in next time on the Pipeline podcast. For Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, I'm Tim McMaster. Thanks for tuning in.